Now, on the BBC World Service, a look back at the life of Nelson Mandela, presented by Alan Little.
The remarkable life began in a lovely wild land that lies low between the foothills of the magnificent Drakensberg Mountains and the vast warm reaches of the Indian Ocean. He was born on the 18th of July 1918 at Umtata, the capital of the Transkei. Apart from life, a strong constitution and an abiding connection to the Tembu royal house, the only thing my father bestowed on me at birth, he wrote, was a name, Rolihlahla. In Xhosa, it means literally pulling the branch of a tree, but its colloquial meaning, more accurately, would be troublemaker. Mandela's father was a chief of the Tembu royal family in the Eastern Cape. Rolihlahla was born to lead. His sister, Mabel Timakwe, remembers him as a child. Life was very hard at home. We were not starving. We had plenty of food and sour milk. But we had no possessions. When my father was about to die, he gave my brother his clothes so that he could go to school. My father had four wives. There were so many of us at home. My brother loved us very much. He would bring us all together and teach us to sing. My brother, when he was young, was very playful, but when he was provoked, he would get cross. Education, he wrote, is the great engine of personal development. We Africans were limited by lesser facilities, but not by what we could read or think or dream. It was the mission schools run by foreign churches that provided the source of that education. Mandela's schooling combined in him the gentle traditional values of his African upbringing, tolerance, deference, respect for seniority, with those of liberal European thought. The Afrikaner, he wrote, was hostile to Africans learning English, for English was a foreign tongue to the Afrikaner and the language of emancipation to us. The veteran journalist Benjamin Pogrand of the Rand Daily Mail saw Mandela as the archetypal product of the mission school culture.
He came through a British missionary education in the Eastern Cape, and that education tended to be paternalistic and patronizing towards blacks, but also gave them a very good grounding in the three R's and in English culture and things like that, and produced rather tolerant, liberal people. And Mandela was a product of that. And in very many ways, he's a 19th century liberal gentleman.
Armed with his mission school education, Mandela went to Johannesburg to study law. There, in the sprawling, impoverished townships that were springing up around the gold-mining flatlands of the Witwatersrand, he joined the liberation struggle and the party he would one day lead, the African National Congress. In 1948, the Afrikaner nationalists won the whites-only general election and set the country on a path that would change the course of southern African history. The apartheid state was born. The ANC embarked on a campaign of protest known as the Defiance Campaign. They chose six of the most hated racial segregation laws and publicly, conspicuously disobeyed them. The campaign was emphatically non-violent. The Defiance Campaign began in 1952, by which time Mandela had emerged as an articulate and admired leader and organizer. The journalist Anthony Sampson knew him.
At that time, he was very aloof from many of his own colleagues, obviously formidable, and very impressive to look at, of course, tall, relatively silent, with a very obviously powerful bearing and physique. He was a great boxer, apart from other things. And he seemed to rather hold himself aloof from the more sort of talkative and informal kind of ANC leaders.
It was a campaign of peaceful, emphatically non-violent, selective civil disobedience. It began one winter morning when 33 defiers entered a railway station through a door marked Whites Only. They sang liberation songs and chanted slogans. Their leader was Raymond Mutlaba.
We said we are going to embark on what we called the defiance of the unjust laws. You go to a post office, the black people must enter a new entrance written non-Europeans only. Europeans only. And we said, well, we are going to go through the European only entrance and we're going to defy such laws. We had already implemented what was known as the Mandela Plan. Mandela Plan was to divide, say, the township into zones, cells, streets, and so on. And with that organizational structure, you were able to manage the township very easily.
In June 1955, 3,000 people attended a rally called the Congress of the People to launch what became known as the Freedom Charter. It asserted that South Africa belonged to all those who lived in it, black and white alike. The Afrikaner Nationalist Government denounced the gathering as communist. A year later, 156 of its leaders were arrested and accused of treason. Mandela was arrested after being woken by a knock on his door in the dead of night. His friend Mary Benson was in court.
The early stages of the trial had ridiculous bits of evidence coming out. Policemen with hopeless notes of what they'd heard at meetings, that they were trying to make it sound as if the ANC had been calling for terrible violence and so forth.
In theory, they all faced the death penalty. But the trial dragged on inconclusively for 5 years until eventually the prosecution fell apart. Mandela and Sisulu and the others were acquitted. Their lawyers were hoisted shoulder high by a crowd outside the courthouse. They sang the liberation anthem, Nkosi Sikelele I Afrika, God Bless Africa. They did not know that its haunting, powerful strains and its promise of freedom would themselves soon be outlawed. The treason trial now recalls an age of innocence in South Africa's struggle, the relative calm before the approaching storm. Sharpeville began as a peaceful demonstration against one of the most detested pieces of apartheid legislation. The pass laws required all black Africans to carry identity documents, authorising them to be in a given place at a given time, and banning them from so-called white areas. At Sharpeville Township in the southern Transvaal, on March the 21st, 1960, thousands marched on the police station without passes, defying the police to challenge them en masse. The police opened fire. 68 blacks were killed. 180 were injured. Many were shot in the back. For the young Mandela, it was a turning point.
There are many people who feel that it is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and non-violence against a government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people. And I think the time has come for us to consider, in the light of our experiences in this stay-at-home, whether the methods which we have applied so far are adequate.
The government declared a state of emergency. The ANC, whose leaders now publicly burned their own passes, was banned. Mandela went into hiding. Benjamin Pogrund was one of the few who knew how to contact him.
The whole of the police force was hunting for him as he was issuing calls from underground for this three-day strike. He became known as the Black Pimpernel. We had a regular place where I would meet him. It was on a street corner in a Johannesburg suburb, and I'd meet him at dusk. And here was this imposing, tall, authoritative-looking figure, and the only disguise he wore, he was dressed in a boiler suit. And I would pick him up on the street corner, and we would go and park in a dark street and spend half an hour or an hour talking about things. And we kept up that contact all the way through.
Mandela had spent 2 decades preaching disciplined non-violence, and it had led only to further oppression. Reluctantly, he now accepted the task of building an armed wing for the ANC. He became commander-in-chief of Mkhonto weSizwe, Spear of the Nation. The Black Pimpernel was now a wanted terrorist. Mary Benson remembers him disguised as a window cleaner, a motor mechanic, a chauffeur.
I arrived there at this little bungalow house, and then in strode Mandela, and he was in a wonderful, very ebullient mood. He said how extraordinary it was for the first time in many years to be able to just travel the whole country, which he was doing. And then when he had to go, he said he would give me a lift back to near where I was staying in Johannesburg. So he wore this white chauffeur's coat and peaked cap. So he was the chauffeur driving and I was the madam in the back.
Mkhonto Sizwe adopted a program of sabotage. On December the 16th, 1961, the ANC ended its non-violent struggle by planting three bombs in Johannesburg, Port Elizabeth and Durban. Mandela spent 17 months on the run before being captured on the road from Durban to Johannesburg. His arrest caused a national sensation. He appeared in court in Johannesburg in the very courtroom where he had practiced as an attorney. "In a way I had never quite comprehended before," he wrote later. "I realised the role I could play in court and the possibilities before me as a defendant. I was the symbol of justice in the court of the oppressor, the representative of the great ideals of freedom, fairness and democracy in a society that dishonoured those virtues. I realised then and there that I could carry on the fight even within the fortress of the enemy." The magistrate jailed him for 5 years. While Mandela was in jail, his comrades outside continued the sabotage campaign. In 1963, almost the entire leadership of Mkhonto Sizwe were captured when police swooped on a farmhouse north of Johannesburg. They seized enough evidence to convict them all, including Mandela, of high treason, for which the penalty was death. Mandela was brought from his prison cell back to court. Ahmed Katrada was one of his co-accused.
He said that we should not appeal if we are sentenced to death, on the grounds that the courts of that time would never acquit us, and the appeal court would not overrule the judgment of the Supreme Court, so we should not appeal. And for political reasons also we should not appeal, because we had decided to conduct the trial politically, to admit to a lot of the allegations that were made, especially the allegations that were true, to admit to them. So it was felt that it would be an anticlimax if after all that, and if we are sentenced, we go and appeal. And that was accepted by all of us.
Again, it was Mandela who urged that the trial should be conducted politically, that the defendants should challenge the legitimacy of the court. Joel Joffe, one of the defense lawyers.
They were there with the prospect of being hanged present all the time during that trial, and yet they behaved very normally. There was lots of laughter, lots of fun, actually, in preparing the defense. The prosecutor would do his best to torment and taunt the accused, and it was impossible to provoke them, even though they were tremendously angry at much of what happened, because it was important for them to be calm.
By now, the United Nations had voted to impose sanctions against South Africa. The anti-apartheid struggle was spreading beyond the confines of the country. Mandela's confidence and courage were immense. He decided to include in his closing speech from the dock an open challenge to the judge. He would, he told Joffe, tell the court that he was prepared to die for the values he had dedicated his life to upholding. It was a dangerous, potentially fatal gesture of defiance.
We as lawyers said, well, that's actually a challenge to the court to sentence you to death. You must take it out. And he thought about it and said in the end, no, he wouldn't. And the wording was, it is an ideal for which I have lived. It is an ideal for which I still hope to live and see realized. But if it needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die. And at the end of his 5-hour address to the court, he took off, when he got to the last paragraph, he took off his spectacles, looked the judge straight in the eyes and repeated these words. And he then sat down quietly, and there was an intense silence about this court. For a minute, there was not a sound in that court until some women in the public gallery burst into tears.
Until the very last minute, when you stand up to hear the sentence, you still think that the death sentence may still come. And it was a sigh of relief when the judge passed the life sentence.
There is a small rocky outcrop, windswept and barren, that sits in the cold waters of Cape Bay, 18 miles from the southern extremity of Africa. Robben Island has been used as a prison by the Dutch, then the British, and the Afrikaners. African leaders have been jailed there for three centuries. The magnificent contours of Cape Town's Table Mountain are visible from the island, but it is a place from which there is, notoriously, no escape. When the prisoners arrive there, the guards greet them with a single, chilling welcome. This is the island. This is where you will die.
When we were sent to jail, we had the feeling that we had been victorious and that the people who actually were the accused were the government itself. And that kept us very much alive. And then when we noticed that the ideas for which we had committed our lives were still very much alive, even though we're in jail, we also got a lot of strength as a result.
Ahmed Kathrada was the youngest of the convicted men, and as an Indian, the only one who wasn't classified as black. Even in jail, the apartheid regime imposed its artificial and hated racial distinctions.
We landed on Robben Island on a Saturday morning, the 13th of June. It was bitterly cold and raining. So when it came to changing clothes, there were long pants for me and socks and shoes. With the Africans, short pants, no socks. Instinctively, we thought we should revolt against this. But Mandela and Sisulu said, no, we would be wrong. We should fight for equality at a higher level.
The sentence included hard labor. The men were set to work breaking rocks in a lime quarry.
When we started, our hands were full of blisters, all of us bleeding. We tried to smooth things up by singing as general business do so. But even that was stopped. We were the only prisoners who were stopped from singing.
When we got to Robben Island, we elected him as our spokesman. Nelson likes arguing. He would argue and argue. He would say, even if it comes to fisticuff, I'll take you up. And he meant it. In those days, he was hefty. He never really beat up anybody. But given the opportunity, he would have done it.
There was a period in 1974 when virtually the whole of Robben Island went down under a flu epidemic. In our section, it was Mandela and three people who had just recently arrived on the island, whose resistance was still strong. They didn't go down. The rest of us were flat, we couldn't move. Mandela, every day, took out our toilet buckets, cleaned them, emptied them, cleaned them, brought water for us, brought food for us. And it helped a great deal to keep our morale high.
If Robben Island was intended to crush the spirit of the liberation movement, it backfired. The prison walls contained now some of the most educated men in the country. They transformed it to a place of learning, the university of the struggle. Governor Mbeki.
We insisted on everyone attending political education classes. We literally drew up a syllabus. You see, because there are seven jails on Robben Island, you can't meet your people. You have got to do it by written word. And that's not easy either.
The white Liberal MP Helen Suzman was the only woman in the South African Parliament and the only member to vote against many of its most draconian state of emergency measures. She was an early visitor to the island.
What was really quite awe-inspiring because, you know, the journey itself, you go over on a ferry boat and it takes about an hour from Cape Town, from the harbour. The sea can be very rough if there's a southeaster blowing, and one arrives at this little jetty, and I saw this long building with a passage all the way down and cells on either side, and I was stopped at the very first cell where I said good morning to the man who was in it. I happened to know him, actually. And he said, don't waste time talking to anybody else. Go to the end of the line and you will find Nelson Mandela. He is our leader.
From the beginning, the regime tried to neutralise Mandela by separating him from the rank and file, by buying him off with special treatment. It was a technique they repeated for nearly 30 years, without success.
The top officials from Pretoria came right at the beginning, and the head of security in South African prisons approached him and said, look, Mandela, all you do is go to the doctor. We have spoken to the doctor. You go and tell the doctor that you because of health, you don't want to work at the quarry and you want special food. And the doctor will give it to you. And Mandela said, no, I'm not prepared to do that. I'll eat what the rest of the prisoners are eating and I'll work. So right through, he never asked for exemption from work.
Mandela stamped his own authority on the island by refusing to concede defeat. He treated his warders with his characteristic civility. He won them over with his charm. His lawyer, George Bizos, remembers one visit.
And he was brought to the consulting room with two warders in front, two warders on each side and two at the back. And the thing about Mandela was that he didn't behave like a prisoner, ever. He was setting the pace at which they were walking towards me. And quite deadpan said, George, allow me to introduce you to my guard of honor. At least one of them actually smiled.
I remember one commanding officer calling in Comrade Mandela and virtually breaking down and saying, Mandela, nobody listens here. My warders give instructions, nobody obeys any instruction. It can't go on like this. I'm the commanding officer. And Comrade Mandela comes back and he says, well, I've got to speak to the prisoners. The whole thing was breaking down.
Since June the 16th, when South African troops and police opened fire on a peaceful school children's demonstration, the white government has presided over the largest massacre of its black population since South Africa came into existence. The schoolboy who led that day's protest was 19-year-old Tsietsi Mashinini.
I saw a child of 8, and this kid innocently raised his fist in a black power sign and said, power, and they opened fire on this 8-year kid. When I went to the mortuary on the weekend, I saw this kid at the mortuary riddled with bullets beyond recognition.
The Soweto uprising in 1976 changed everything. School children in South Africa's largest black township took to the streets to demonstrate against the imposition of Afrikaans as the medium of instruction. The country exploded in an orgy of grief and rage. A whole new generation of leaders emerged, more militant, more radical, more violent. They initially disparaged the Mandela generation's commitment to reconciliation. They too ended up on the island. Ahmed Katrada.
The 76 Soweto crowd came in, young people, very militant. They didn't belong to any organization. And then we smuggled notes to them and they smuggled notes back to us. And eventually they all settled down and I'd say 90% of them joined the ANC in prison.
The white government was unrepentant. In his Christmas address that year, the Prime Minister, John Vorster, gave menacing notice.
The storm has not struck yet. We are only experiencing the whirlwinds that go before it. It can pass on, or it can even spend itself before it strikes us in all its fury. Who can foretell? But our house is not built on sand, and even if the signs are positive that it will strike us, we must not fear. On our flight into the new year, I do say to you to fasten your seat belts, but I have no doubt that we will safely land at our destination.
And the man who would one day become a cabinet minister in Mandela's first government was, in a 1977 visit to the United States, an angry defender of this garrison of white privilege in an increasingly hostile world, the then Foreign Minister Pigburtta.
We have never harmed the United States. We don't owe you a cent. We have never made a demand in your taxpayers' pockets. We've paid our debts. We've sided with you in the United Nations 100%. And now you come and you push aside this hand of friendship. We don't understand this at all. And we are not going to accept one man, one vote. It means our destruction. We will not accept it now, not tomorrow, never ever.
These were the wilderness years for Mandela. For generations of South Africans, he was now no more than a heroic memory.
For quite a few years, he tended to disappear from public sight. But there was one person who went on fighting for him, and that was Winnie, his second wife. And Winnie, beautiful, clever, articulate, she never gave up. I don't think there was a single person in that country whom the police hated more than Winnie Mandela, and they went for her. She hated them in equal measure, and gradually her own persona developed, but initially it was all for the cause of fighting for Nelson Mandela.
Mandela had met Winnie during the 5-year treason trial. I was struck by her beauty, he wrote later. I knew that I wanted to have her as my wife, and I told her so. Her spirit, her passion, her youth, her courage, her willfulness. I felt all of these things the moment I first saw her. Their marriage did not survive his years in jail. Though they had 2 daughters, the Mandelas lived together for no more than a few months while he was on the run. 2 years after his release from prison, they were divorced. Later, on his 80th birthday, Mandela was to marry the woman who by then had become his constant companion, Graça Machel, the widow of the assassinated Mozambican president Samora Machel. But back in the late 70s, that happiness was still to come. Mandela was in prison, and with the leaders of the Soweto uprising now in Robben Island too, the liberation movement gathered cohesiveness. By jailing them together, the apartheid regime delivered the generation of 76 to Mandela. It further enhanced his by now immeasurable mystique. By the 1980s, Mandela was a household name throughout the world. On his 70th birthday, tens of thousands gathered at Wembley Stadium for a celebration rock concert. It was broadcast live on television and radio around the world. The folk singer Harry Belafonte led the tributes.
We salute you, Nelson Mandela. And we want to see you and your fellow political prisoners free.
The passing of his 70th birthday was also a landmark for the South African authorities. Coincidentally, Mandela, venerated throughout the world, was in declining health. His lawyer, Ismail Ayob, announced that he was ill.
Mr. Mandela has tuberculosis. It's clear that his condition has been deteriorating for some time. He's very thin. He's on his feet. And suddenly looks very old.
It threw the South African regime into a panic. Benjamin Pogrund.
They had become increasingly worried over the years that he could die on their hands. And they were terrified of that, that they'd have a natural-born martyr there. They didn't want that. They didn't know what to do with it. They were in a terrible dilemma. They kept trying to get him to go out of jail. They made a number of approaches to him, offering him release if he would go to the Transkei, one of the Bantustans, and he turned it down. And he kept insisting there could be no conditions for his release. They were desperate for him to go out of jail, but on their terms. Provided he promised that he wouldn't do this or wouldn't do that or would go somewhere, if he had said he'd go to London or Timbuktu, anywhere, he would have been out like a shot. They wanted him out. But he wouldn't go except to South Africa and with total unconditional release for himself and for his friends. He drew the line on that. There was a total principle that he stuck to all the way through.
By now, the apartheid president, P.W. Botha, had opened secret talks with Mandela. In 1985, he offered to release him, provided he renounced the use of violence. Mandela refused.
Amanda! Amanda!
In February of that year, his daughter Zinzi, in defiance of the law, read aloud a letter from her father to a euphoric crowd in Soweto's Jabulani Stadium.
My father says, I cannot and will not give any undertaking at a time when I and you, the people, are not free. Your freedom and mine cannot be separated. I will return. Amanda!
From what source does the Mandela mystique spring? In part, it is from his refusal through 27 years in prison to depart from his guiding vision. He never lost faith in the multiracial ideal, in the notion he articulated with such force at his trial, that the enemy was not white people, but white supremacy. And he never once broke ranks with the liberation movement, never once elevated himself above it.
The South African black nationalist leader, Mr. Nelson Mandela, is to be freed from prison tomorrow. The announcement was made by President F.
I wish to put it plainly that the government has taken a firm decision to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally. I am serious about bringing this matter to finality without delay.
The new president, F.W. de Klerk, made the announcement on February the 2nd, 1990. Unconditional release. My freedom and yours cannot be separated. The unshakable vision had triumphed.
They were scared stiff that the moment he came out of jail, he would simply say, let's march to Pretoria and tear the whole place down. But then as they began to have contacts with him, I think to their surprise, they found this astonishing human being who didn't want to kill them all off, who was willing to discuss things with them, who had certain very basic principles about his release, but who was essentially putting out the hand of friendship.
Sunday, 11th of February, 1990, the world about to catch its first glimpse of its most famous political prisoner in a quarter of a century is transfixed. Inside the prison walls, the prisoner himself appeared oblivious to the legendary stature he had acquired. Cyril Ramaphosa was with him during his last hours of captivity.
Inside the prison walls, before he got out, I was amazed at the level of calmness, total relaxation on his part. Before we walked out of prison, he served tea and cake, and he himself doing the serving and all that. Totally unlike a person who is about to walk out of prison for the first time.
In glaring contrast, the atmosphere outside the prison was frenzied. The release, scheduled for 3 p.m., was delayed and delayed. Archbishop Desmond Tutu was among the crowds.
They had said he was going to arrive at a particular time, and there were the people. And it was clear, that they were getting a little restive as he didn't appear, and they kept postponing his arrival. And they really got ugly. It was getting quite dark, in fact, when he arrived. And if there had been a roof, the shouts would have taken that roof off.
Crowd are just catching a sight of this figure now. Yes, he's alongside Winnie Mandela, both of them raising their arms in the air. Many in the crowd can see them. A great roar of ANC goes up from the crowd. Everybody's now rushing up to the prison gate. And now Mr. Mandela walks through the gate. He's a free man as of this moment.
I think most of us are still thinking it is a dream. It's not really happened. This is what we would like to see happen. But it was true.
It is a quite remarkable moment. Now the police motorcycles setting off and the convoy follows.
We were in the car in front of him. We were leading the procession and we saw the many people, white people, colored people, African people along the route. And quite a number of white people were just waving meekly. But you could see that they wanted to see this man. They wanted to see this legend.
What struck him, something that he obviously has never forgotten, is the number of white people, he says, because he had gone into jail at a time when the polarization was very, very, very severe. And for most white people, this was the devil incarnate. He was touched. He was deeply touched. And it must have had an effect on a great deal of what has followed. I mean, his magnanimity is not something that was provoked by that, but I think it was deepened.
By the time he arrived at Cape Town City Hall, he was hours late.
Amanda! Amanda! In Africa!
Again, the central theme was reiterated. My struggle will not deliver liberation. The people will liberate themselves.
I stand here before you, not as a prophet, but as a humble servant of you, the people.
It is significant that the first words he uttered from the balcony in Cape Town was that I am a disciplined member of the African National Congress. He wanted to dispel any notion that he was doing anything on his own behalf. The government believed that they could actually co-opt and isolate Nelson Mandela. It was a miscalculation.
Mandela moved quickly to allay white fears and contain black expectations. He entered talks with the old enemy. The men who jailed him began to see him now as their only hope, including Pick Berta.
Well, the first meeting was very impressive. His statement there, I will never forget. It was a very impressive statement, but with no bitterness, no vengefulness, not a sign of hatred. At no stage did he endeavor to exploit or use his 27 years in prison.
The international community saw the statesman in him too and began to cultivate him as the future president of the country. Sir Robin Rennick was the British ambassador to South Africa.
I remember shortly after Mandela was released, I used to go to see him in a tiny house in Soweto. The third time I said, next time, why don't we meet in the best restaurant in Johannesburg? I didn't think he'd done that before. It was only about 3 weeks, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, short time after he was released. We went along to this restaurant together, and I remember him walking into the place, immaculately dressed, astonished restaurant goers, most of whom had voted for 20 years to keep him in jail. I remember him walking up to every single one of them, shaking their hands, greeting them, recognizing one or two of them. He's wonderfully effective at co-opting his political opponents. He's wonderfully effective in persuading you that you ought to be trying to help him, indeed working for it.
But the peace process was to prove long and bitterly fought. There was little trust between the two principal players, Mandela and de Klerk. But Mandela never lost faith that peace could be achieved through reconciliation. There would be no place in the new South Africa for retribution. No place for vengeance.
The essence of reaching a political solution means that you must let bygones be bygones. Otherwise, you must not think in terms of negotiation. When you negotiate, you sit down with your former enemy.
It was not a universally applauded position. Mandela had to deliver his own support base to the peace process on these terms. He had to persuade them to put the past behind them, to draw a line under the crimes committed against them. Albertina Sisulu was sceptical.
When he came out of jail and told us about the reconciliation, we thought that he's mad. We can't reconcile with the murderers. We have killed our children. We have killed people in jail. We can't, you know. He called a meeting, a conference sort of. He lectured to us to say, listen, our people have died unnecessarily. We don't want a blood bath in South Africa because that blood will not come from anybody else but from a black man. You know, it's only then that we understood what he meant by reconciliation.
By April 1993, the country was consumed by a multi-pronged, low-intensity civil war that was claiming thousands of lives. The Zulu-based Inkatha Freedom Party, led by Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi and supported by the White Right and elements of the security forces, was at loggerheads with the ANC. White militias were threatening to go to war to prevent democracy. The Afrikaner resistance movement, led by the firebrand neo-Nazi Eugene Terblanche, preached their gospel of violence, hatred and racial purity.
Many times in the past I said, if they want to take this country by force and violence, they'll meet us over the barrel of a gun.
Part of the old regime conspired to plunge the country into a spiral of violence that would derail the transition to democracy and preserve white rule. On April the 10th, Chris Hani, one of the liberation movement's most popular and charismatic black leaders, was gunned down outside his home. The country was in mortal danger.
Many of those who turned up at this overcrowded Soweto stadium to hear Mandela and to see for the last time Chris Hani were turned away. In their frustration, some attacked a nearby exhibition center. The police, in response, used shotguns and tear gas. Several people were injured in the clashes. Inside the stadium, Nelson Mandela served notice to President de Klerk that the price for Hani's assassination would be the realization of his dream of democracy now.
We want an election date now. We want to know when we will have a government of our choice.
Bobby Godsall, the director of the mining conglomerate Anglo-American, believes that in 1993 South Africa stood at the gates of civil war and that it was Nelson Mandela alone who was able to pull the country back from catastrophe.
Nelson Mandela held this nation together in the time of its greatest peril in recent decades, actually, which was the moment of Chris Hani's assassination. That could well have led to a civil war. He held it together by the attitude that he took. His first comment on hearing of the brutal, the grotesque shooting of a man in his house, in front of his family, by an unknown but clearly white assassin, his reaction was to emphasize racial unity, to urge the nation to calm, to urge people not to engage in retaliatory actions. That was one of the great moments in his career, because this was a time when the nation could easily have descended into a civil war from which it might not have ever recovered.
Mandela told de Klerk that the people would tolerate no more delay, and a date was set for the election, April the 27th, 1994. The country had a year to prepare. Mandela had, finally, to persuade the white right to take part. General Constant Fulyun, a respected veteran of the apartheid-sponsored war in Angola, was preparing to go to war again. Mandela persuaded him to bring his people into the electoral process.
We met Mr. Mandela in Johannesburg in a house in great secrecy, and we had the first about 3 hours talk with Mr. Mandela on the issue of the Afrikaner people and what our demands for the future in South Africa would be. Right from the moment go, I found Mr. Mandela a person with whom I would get along and I would be able to negotiate. He mentioned his desire to find a peaceful solution between the Afrikaner and the Africans. And that coincided with exactly what I had in mind.
Today is a day like no other before it. Voting in our first free and fair election has begun. Today marks the dawn of our freedom.
April the 27th is a public holiday in South Africa now. It is known as Freedom Day. Mandela went to Natal to vote. Before he did so, he visited the grave nearby of John Dube, the first president of the African National Congress. As I stood over his grave, he wrote, I thought not of the present, but of the past. My mind dwelt on the heroes who had fallen so that I might be where I was that day.
Sharpeville, Matola, Alexandra, Barberoni,
ma me lo di Google tu.
Mandela was sworn in as president on May the 10th in Union Buildings, Pretoria. It represented not the triumph of one people over another, he said, but a victory for justice, for peace, for human dignity.
Never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another and suffer the indignity. And suffer the indignity of being the skunk of the world. The sun shall never set on so glorious a human achievement. Let freedom reign. God bless Africa. I thank you.
The struggle entered a new phase. Mandela's challenge in government was to overturn the legacy of apartheid, to redress the enormous imbalance of an economy designed to uphold white privilege. Benjamin Pogrund.
Of course, Mandela had the huge problem of the inheritance. You know, when you look at South African newspapers and you talk to whites there, it's as though the ANC took over a flourishing economy, a marvellously run country, a free democratic society. It was all rubbish. The nationalists had turned it into the closest thing to a banana republic imaginable. The economy was in absolute tatters. The corruption was colossal throughout the country, but particularly among the white leaders. The crime was terrible because people had no future. Schools were in a state of total unrest because of the resistance to apartheid. It was a mess that he inherited. And it was too much to expect that you could just press a button and overnight it would all come right again.
The scale of the task quickly became clear. Mandela warned the people not to expect miracles. The people responded with a quiet, patient forbearance that confounded those who predicted social unrest brought on by disappointed expectation. But his unassailable stature was to cause problems for South Africa's fledgling democracy. How do you develop a credible opposition when the head of state has acquired an almost saintly persona? The leader of the small opposition Democratic Party, Tony Leon.
He embodies and personifies the suffering of black people in South Africa. And that, I would say, is one of the problems. I think of what Brecht said, pity the land that has no hero. And then the response was, pity the land in need of a hero. And I think that is a problem. It's difficult to be a political head of office and the sort of living, symbolic, as it were, moral savior of your country, because then you fall into a terrible trap, which means that there's no accountability and there's no criticism and you're en route to a one-party state.
But for Mandela, from his days in the Tembu Royal House in rural Transkei to his mission school, from liberation leader to reluctant fugitive, from Robben Island to the office of state president, the guiding light never dimmed. He believed in, fought for, was possessed by the highest ideals of our time. And first among them was the idea that the people can and should govern themselves. He was a hero in a land in desperate, suffering need of one. His lasting legacy may be that the need has been overcome.
He realized that he was a man of destiny. But in his own words, he has never regarded himself as a prophet or a messiah. Although he has taken a leading role, he has always acknowledged the contribution of others. Mandela, Sisulu, Lutuli, Tadu, Stephen Biko, Govan Mbembe, Rava Tsebukwe, Baba Tambo, Basop.
He was a source of inspiration. He was a man of legendary proportions in many ways. And he was a person who, in many ways, made us feel so strengthened. The speech that he made at the Rivonia trial, when he said he was even prepared to die, is one of those speeches which just made us more bold, which made me also personally feel that I could go to the end of the world in terms of my commitment to the struggle, because there he was, a person who said he was prepared to die. And it made me also feel I could make many sacrifices to ensure that our people are liberated.
And Pik Botha, the man who told the world that white South Africans would never accept one person, one vote, happily joined Mandela's first government as a cabinet minister. His personal journey from unrepentant white supremacist to trustee of multiracial democracy mirrors that of white South Africa itself.
On the one hand, one is almost overawed by a feeling of remorse and monumental sadness because of what I call this, the ingredients of a Greek tragedy. On the other hand, one can't remain a victim of the past and of remorse and a captive. And as he himself has indicated and clearly demonstrated, he wants a better future for black and white. So one looks at his life and at the past with mixed feelings of sadness, remorse, and yet on the basis of what has been achieved, with new hope and a feeling of joy almost, that this could have happened in South Africa, proving what the Romans used to say, out of Africa always emerges something new.
Mandela's life has been a glorious one for us black South Africans. We worshipped the memory of this absent leader. I mean, he became a household name to children who had never seen him, who were born after he'd gone to Robben Island. We were very lucky. I suppose it occurs in the history of all nations that the nation will throw up a leader of the dimensions of Mandela. We indeed are blessed to have had a man of the stature and character of Rolihlahla Mandela.
The Life of Nelson Mandela, presented by Alan Little.